This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Thanks. This is working. So it's very nice to be back. As Sina said, we thought it was just going to be three, and it wound up being more, but they weren't all at Cabinet. We went on the road for a while. We went to Joe's Pub, and we went to the Boston ICA. We went to Oberlin, where we got ripped off by a student named Cole Evlev. If Cole Evlev ever asks you to do a talk show, don't. We went to
Miami.
We went to not in Miami. But it's really. After all that traveling, it's really nice to be back here, and it made sense to come back here because this is really where it was born, and this is where the format operates best, and this is really where it should be. And it's especially nice to be back and performing this tonight because, as some of you may know, March 24th, 2016 is the 40th anniversary of March 24th, 1976, and in honor of that anniversary, I would like to read the names of all the late night talk show guests who appeared on March 24th, 1976. Anthony Newley. Hoyt Axton. Don't laugh, this is very serious. Gore Vidal. Stockard Channing, FBI Director Clarence Kelly, that was Tom Snyder, Desi Arnaz, Cicely Tyson, John Biner, Telly Savalas, Brett Summers, Freddie Roman, George Burns, Walter Matthau, Richard Benjamin, Neil Simon. Okay, and without further ado, talk show is, as Sina mentioned, fairly strictly formatted according to the canons of a real talk show. There's an opening monologue, that was it. There is a sideman. The Johnny Carson sideman was famously derided for being a drunk. Our sideman gets people drunk. Eben, how's it going?
I might be able to be drunk too.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
It's going well. It's good to be back, as you said. Were you single the last time we did a year?
No. No, I was not.
Okay, all right. Because you're not now.
No, I'm not.
As far as I know.
No.
I wasn't sure how far back that was.
No. I was accompanied. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. Yes. One of the people in this audience is the person I'm married to, but I don't want to embarrass that person, so. Okay. Patter, shtick, all the kind of things you would have on a real talk show. What's atypical about the talk show is it's actually about people with interesting jobs. It's not about celebrities, it's not about artists, it's about people with interesting jobs, and obviously lots of jobs are interesting. Practically all jobs are interesting if you think about them closely enough. So the format is also, within that, a little bit unusual. I ask them questions for 10 minutes, and then you guys get to ask them questions for 10 minutes. Tonight we have two guests. We have locksmith Alberto Zeidan, and we have Gossip Magazine fact checker Anonymous. Talk show also features a segment in the middle, which is sort of about the stuff that you know too much about when you should be doing your job, but it's not your job. And in this case, this is a segment we like to call Minor Obsessive, and this is a slide talk, there's no Q&A. And tonight's Minor Obsessive will be Paul Lucas, who will be giving a slide presentation on the evolution of baseball's pants-hosiery dialectic. Yeah? For every talk show, Eben invents a new cocktail. This cocktail is always nameless at the beginning of the night. By the end of the night, it is named. After Minor Obsessive, I will forget to ask Eben what the ingredients are, and he will remind me in some suitably rude way. And then he'll tell you guys what the ingredients are, and you'll have some time to maybe have a second round. Evan will be coming through with cocktails for everyone as we interview our second guest. And then when it's all done, we will actually have a contest to name the cocktail. Do we take the names before? No, we take the names at the end, and then we vote on them immediately, right?
Yeah.
All right, and I'll also forget to do that. I'll say thank you and good night, and Evan will be like, my effing cocktails, and I'll say right. And then everyone will be drunk because he makes strong cocktails, and then we'll be done. So, without further ado, please give a warm welcome to our first guest, locksmith Alberto Zeidan. Thank you. I wasn't kidding. All right, so Alberto, how does one become a locksmith?
I dropped out of college to form a rock band. Actually, I left at the university's behest. I know you have a fact checker coming up, so I didn't really drop out. And there was an ad said, locksmith will train, and he hired me because I had my driver's license number memorized, and he said, a good memory is good for a locksmith. I never really figured out why it'd be better. It was good for a locksmith opposed to any other job, but he hired me.
Maybe he saw something in your eye.
Maybe. He was a nasty man, but he was a really good locksmith to learn from.
You should use the mic. Is the mic on? Oh, no, it's okay. I'm not even sure it's...
No, it's on.
Yeah, all right. You can take it out of there if you want. This was in New York?
No, in Miami.
Miami, okay. So you apprenticed to him?
Yeah, I apprenticed with him for a year, and then he did something nasty, so I quit, and I apprenticed with another guy in Miami also, and then I moved to New York.
But so what is the training like?
You get paid very little money. My take-home pay was like $90 a week, and I worked 5.5 days. But, I mean, you learn real locksmith work. You know, you learn how to work on antique keys. You went with other locksmiths to all the jobs. You did a lot of grunt work. You installed safes. You broke through the floor with a jackhammer. All the work.
Locksmiths break through the floor with a jackhammer?
Well, people want floor safes in Miami. There was a lot of them. A lot of money in Miami back then. It was the height of the cocaine trade, so all the drug dealers would call you to install safes. And
oh, so you were doing locksmithing for drug dealers?
Oh yeah.
Because they would like forget the combo, or because they had to install a safe?
No, they would call to install a safe. So they would want a floor safe buried in the concrete under the rug, and then they would buy a safe to stand on top of it. So if somebody comes, they would just steal the safe on top, in theory, and not realize that the money wasn't the one in the other one. Then they'd pat you on the back with a gun, tip you a lot of cash, and say, don't tell anybody.
And this is when you were just an apprentice?
Yeah.
Okay, so, but talk us through just what is it, what, sounds terrible. Can you turn this down a little bit? What is entailed by locksmithing? I mean, like, when you're an apprentice, what's the first thing they teach you?
How a cylinder works, when you put a key in a cylinder, how the pins work, this allows you to understand how to repin a cylinder, how to master key a cylinder, how to pick a lock, how to impression a key, which no one does anymore.
No one impressions a key anymore?
No, it's the industry's changed for the worse.
For the worse?
Yeah. There's most of the people who locksmith in New York right now are just horrible craftsmen. They couldn't be hired in a place that wasn't New York or Chicago or that kind of place.
But I would think New York and Chicago need more security, right?
Clearly they do. There are good people. All the good people have done what I've done. They've gone completely independent. They've left the big companies. The companies have set up a system where you have to be crooked to make money in it. So.
Okay. So wait, now I have a lot of questions. So you are a below the radar locksmith.
I'm a one man right? show. All so word of mouth. Don't advertise. No website. Nothing.
When I booked Alberto, he was like, "It's fine. You can use my name, but do not put my phone number anywhere. Do not add." You know. So why is that? Wouldn't you want to get more business?
Well, I have other interests. The more money you work, the less time you have, and I need time to write and do the other things I do.
Right. Okay. So what makes a bad locksmith?
I mean, there's a couple of things. You're a bad person. That's a good one. outside of that, just if you're not trained, the way it's set up now, if you're locked out, if you walk out of your apartment, the door slams behind you. It's so easy to open that door without damaging anything, but you don't make a lot of money doing that. So people learn to start drilling it or ripping off the cylinder. So now a job that should have been $80 or $100 becomes $500, $600, $800. But the problem is when you do that enough time, it becomes self-manifesting because you don't practice. So now you can't pick a lock. So now you're no longer even faking it. You know, you're not capable of finessing your way.
So basically at that point, you would just take a jackhammer and like just go through the door.
The more damage they do, the more money they'll make.
Okay.
Yeah.
As opposed to you, who are more of a finesse guy.
Right, but I don't do commercial work. I mean, I don't do residential work anymore, like unless I know someone. It's thankless work for the most part.
Why is it thankless?
Because no one really views you. If people screw up, and you screwed up, you lost your keys, you did something stupid, very rarely are you just completely innocent in this. In fact, almost never. And when people screw up, what they want to do, the first thing they want to do is like get the blame off their shoulders and put it on someone else, and you're there to make money off their misfortune. So, and it's 2 a.m. and you're arguing with a drunk to get paid, which is, when you're young, it's fine. It's an excitement. Right now, like, you know, I don't need it.
So now you deal with drunk corporations that lose their keys.
Exactly. Mainly, my customers now are mainly bars and restaurants. All the bartenders I knew when I moved to New York grew up and became bar owners in restaurants. So all my drinking paid off. So that's my clientele.
All your what?
All my drinking paid off finally. Right. Yes.
But this sounds more like installation than actual like picking.
Yeah, right? Almost all of it. Every now and then something happens to a safe, you have to open a safe or they'll lose a key to something, but it's a high turnover business. You fire a manager, you have to change the safe combinations, you have to change the keys. Even if you trust them, it's a smart thing to do. It protects everybody.
Do you work out of a truck? I mean, do you have like a truck full of gear?
I have a car, a little Scion XB, and I have a very small set of tools on gang boxes on wheels. So if I want to go out of town, I can pull them out in 5 minutes, and then I just have a regular car. I don't have commercial plates or anything like that. And I park my car across the street from my house in the East Village. Almost all my customers are either in Lower Manhattan or downtown Brooklyn. So it's pretty easy to get there.
Okay, I think generally, I mean, unless I'm misjudging my audience, which, you know, it wouldn't be the first time, but I would assume that, like, most of us have a vision of a locksmith, like, yeah, installing safes and all that, but what I really imagine you doing is being able to pick any lock. You're like Fantomas, you can like...
You don't pick any lock. Of the standard locks, which most people don't have anymore, I can pick most of them. It's still an inexact science. Nobody picks everything. I have great training in that. I know how to open safes. I know how to open locks. But it's just become a very small part of my job at this point.
But you would be like an Ocean's 11 guy. Like someone would be like, I want to do this heist. Like, let's call Alberto and he'll listen. And
my backup job is to become an art thief, you know. So. Yeah.
Well, that's beyond locks, I guess. But theoretically, you could pick a hotel room lock.
Yeah,
you could. What keeps you from doing it?
Or not picking it. Like, well, first of all, if I'm going to become a thief, I'm not going to be a petty one. So, you have to go after big. I mention art thieves because they have the best gigs. You know, you hear about, you know, Munch, the screen being stolen. Then you read a 6 liters, oh, the painting was recovered. And you never hear about the thief being arrested because the thief sold it back to the insurance company. So it's just a real easy job. You know, I'm sure if you get caught, it's not, but...
But you have to be, like, an acrobat and dodge lasers and...
You got to be, yeah, exactly. Right. You know, I'm probably past the age where that's a good move for me.
Have you ever been tempted to use your skills for evil?
Not really. I can be evil in my day-to-day life.
Okay. So basically, you can pick an old-school lock.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could...
And I can open any lock, but it doesn't mean you're picking it. It means you do damage in a clean way, in a quick, efficient way.
Okay, so without this, with a different kind of finesse.
Right, exactly.
You could open most safes.
Yeah. If I had equipment, I could open bank vaults. I mean, it's the same. The procedure to open a bank vault is the same as the procedure to open the tiniest little safe you buy. It's just there's a lot more metal between here and there. So.
Is it more or less a digital procedure now, or is it more?
Oh no. You have to break in. Although since you say that, people are buying these digital locks and they think they're better, and they're much worse. Mechanical locks give you much better security. To break a mechanical lock, you have to do what I do. You have to learn and train to break digital locks. You know, if you know how to use a computer and can get some software, you can get through them pretty quickly.
Okay, what kind of locks do you have?
Medical locks, good locks.
Medical?
Yeah. Pick-proof locks, I have plates and stuff like that. But I mean, I moved into the East Village when it was a different neighborhood. It's not the neighborhood it is now.
When a locksmith in the East Village in the 80s.
Yeah. When I moved in there, I had friends who wouldn't visit me at night. They were scared to walk down my block. So
what block were you on?
14th between A and B, which wasn't even one of the really bad ones.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So do you like the job?
Oh, I love it. My passion is writing, but short of making a living writing what you love, I couldn't have asked for a better job. It gives you tremendous fodder. The stories you get, and just great insight into human nature, because people, when they call you, they've made a mistake, and they're weak, and they just open up. And you see what simple triggers they have. It's, you know.
You see what?
What simple triggers people have. Like, when I worked nights, a lot of it was women who would have purses stolen at clubs. You know, I went dancing and I left my purse in the corner of the dance floor. You know, obviously something's gonna happen. But they always knew what happened. At some point they would say, you know, I sense someone is there, but I didn't look. And they would give you reasons. Like a common one was, you know, it was a girl, she was pretty. So they just go through this process where they set up a proof to ignore their instinct.
Were you ever, when you picked a lock or let somebody in, or on a safe or a door, what was the most surprising thing you ever found on the other side of the door?
Dead bodies. I found probably at least 10 dead bodies, natural causes, murders.
Oh, yeah. Right, of course.
Someone hasn't heard from Uncle Joe. You don't want to call the cops because, again, you don't want to believe something bad happened. So you go, oh, I'll just call the locksmith, and then you open the door, and, you know, there's Uncle Joe.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Did you ever see something that just made you say, okay, I'm done?
No, because I'm still doing it. But but I saw one that was so gruesome that when the paramedics, the first one who walked in, ran to the bathroom and puked. So it was disgusting. I won't describe it. It's not, but it was nasty.
Okay, I got one more question, then I'll open it up to you guys. How has the business changed? I mean, from Miami to New York, or from the 80s to now?
Well, a lot of the tech stuff, which supposedly saves you money, people buying digital locks so they can change combinations themselves and all that. You know, the equipment is new, but it really hasn't. Oh, the one bad thing is the products being sold now are horrible. They're much worse. The same lock you bought 20 years ago would last you 15 years. Now you buy it new, it'll last you 2 years. The manufacturing, and it's by design. It's just planned obsolescence. It's sad, it's horrible, and it's all over.
Is there a brand that of lock that you or other locksmiths look back with sort of nostalgia, like, oh, they don't make that anymore? Or
sure, all the old Yale locks lasted forever. I mean, you could kick them and throw a hammer at them, and they still worked. It doesn't mean that they would be the most secure now, but, you know, they lasted, they were well built. Now you take apart a lock of metal, it's got plastic in it, and obviously that's not gonna work.
Guys, Nina.
Has your locksmith work affected your writing? And can we hear about your writing?
Great. It gives you great stories. You know, people they're weak. They open up to you. It's very inspiring.
Is that what you write about, though?
I write about lots of things. I mean, I write poetry and fiction. It seeps into everything, but I don't specifically write about locksmith stories. I did a series of them in Miami years ago for a magazine called The Existential Lock. I did like 10 of them. And that was fun. A friend of mine did a book called Keys to the City about 10 or 12 years ago. But I don't like being that deliberate about it. It affects everything, but I don't write about it per se.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could physically describe the sensation of picking different locks. Like, I'm imagining, like, feeling things in this very gentle way, or listening for things clicking into place in a combination lock, which may just be an urban legend.
Well, as far as picking locks, it's all feel, and when you get it, it's cool. It's really, really cool. Especially the first few times you do it, like, wow, look at that. It's really empowering. Safes, it's like, you know, you listen, you see, and you feel. It's three things. If you're talking about manipulation, there's two ways to open it. There's manipulation and penetration, and obviously one involves damage, one doesn't. Manipulation is three different things, and it's a mathematical formula too.
How so?
Which is not that easy to describe. If you don't have the lock in front of you apart, so you understand, you know, if I tell you, well, this is the drop point, this is the fence, if you don't know what that is, it's not going to make any sense.
But what's your favorite lock to open? What's the one that's like satisfying every time?
Anyone that opens.
what's the best way to improvise opening a slam lock? Just a standard slam lock.
A longer version.
What's a slam lock?
And a door that slams shut. Oh, okay. And definitely any longer version of a credit card, plastic, it's something malleable, either a thin piece of metal, but you would like something longer than a credit card, so you can reach in there and still have something to grab onto, and then that's it. I'm not supposed to like just.
An upward down motion or a.
You could do it both ways. At an angle is always good. I start from the bottom, but you know people have different preferences.
Early on in the interview, you mentioned that your first, the first person you apprenticed to did something nasty, and so you left that position. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was?
He didn't like me. He wanted to add extra hours. He had like four employees. I was the newest, and I said, we're going to get paid for those hours, right? And it embarrassed him, and then he retracted on that. And after I had been there 51 weeks, he put me on part-time and let me know that since I was no longer a full-time employee, I was not eligible for my 1 week paid vacation. So I said, well, okay, I quit. just typical money, cheap money stuff, you know.
So as you've described, when somebody calls a locksmith and they've lost their keys or their purse has been stolen or whatever, and like these are moments of great pain and vulnerability, and most of these locksmiths you've described, I mean, not like you and your apprenticeship colleagues, but tend to take advantage of people in those positions. Mm-hmm. So there's a moment that's totally ripe for just extortionate practice. So is there, I mean, do you ever think about like there could be a better system than this system that just sets people up to be extorted?
Well, protect yourself. Like number one, pay by credit card, because the companies do it all the time. If you pay by credit card and you feel you get ripped off, the credit card company is going to side with you. And odds are a company is not going to put up a big fight because they don't want that kind of attention. But a lot of people just get scared, want to forget about it. And talk, you know, ask a price. This is why I have limited sympathy for people. People say, well, it was 2 in the morning and I called this guy. He said he would do it for $30. I go, what would you do for $30 at 2 in the morning? You know, if you don't realize it, so now you know he's begun who's the conversation asking? With a lie. Okay. that's another story. So just protect yourself is the best way. But, you know, as far as changing the system, it's going to get worse. The independent contractor, what they call the sharing economy, has a lot of people working as independent contractors. Most people are not good with money. They end up in a hole really quickly, and they can make it back by ripping you off. And the company that does this, they get to play Pontius Pilate. They don't have to tell you rip someone off, but they just created a system by which you have very little choice. So protect yourself. It's gonna get worse, and not just in my industry, the entire service industry. I hate to say it, but that's where it's going.
Are there like big locksmithing firms, and then there's the independent struggling like yeah. artisanal bookstores and stuff?
I used to work for a huge one. I used to work for a firm just they were huge, and they did that fake advertising that everybody does now, where they had like fake addresses all over New York, and then you show up and the guy goes, yeah, you guys are right around the corner, right? The lots of big ones. And they will give you generally the worst service. But the problem is people like me aren't going to do the night job anymore. We all did our time. We're like, you know, so like I said, protect yourself. Be smart. Pay with credit card. And, you know, don't be afraid to fight it. You know, odds are that they're just going to let it go.
So a couple minutes ago, you said something about I'm not supposed to say something. Well, I'm wondering about the licensing. And then more importantly, like what do you see as the locksmith code of ethics?
The way I was raised, you were supposed to have integrity. You were supposed to understand that you know what you can do has a danger to it. You deal with one person. You don't give keys to other people. If I go in someone's house and you know there's a beautiful Picasso, I mean, I never say, gee, that's a great Picasso, because immediately, it gets very strange.
We actually interviewed somebody once whose job is to paint replicas of artworks for collectors so that they can keep the real one in storage. In case
I'm sure that's a huge job in New York, because there's a lot of art in private homes here. I mean, when you work with a job like I do, you see a lot of it.
But so, what is the licensing like?
You give $100. It's not, you know, you would like to think it's more. They take your fingerprints, you give $100. I know lots of ex-cons who are locksmiths, which I honestly have no issue with that. I mean, really, the way we treat ex-cons is really nasty. But and also, if you want to learn to be a thief, you don't have to go through the hassle that I did. You know, locksmithing, you learn a lot of stuff. You know, 80% of what I learned is not going to help me be a thief. So if I really wanted to be a thief, I could just skip all that other stuff, you know. So
you had a question. Let's take oh, sorry, he had a question, then this guy, then that guy, and then I think we're going to have to, we can catch Alberto after drinks.
This might be an elementary question, but why is a skeleton key called a skeleton key?
It's technically a bit key. It's because it had, in the days of those old kind of locks, skeleton keys are cut for the various different wafers. But if it just has one very small turn on it, you can maybe get past the wafers on certain locks, not all of them, and go behind everything and just get to the lateral bolt and bypass it. That's why it's called the skeleton key.
Because it's bare bones. Yeah. But the skeleton key, like as a myth, like you know, when I was a little kid, yeah. It was like, yeah, you have a skeleton key, and I can open anything.
And people have thought, yeah, you got a skeleton key in there? No, I don't. It's, you know, it was bad. Probably a better question 150 years ago.
What's the best way to lock up a bike on the streets of New York?
Get those chains that are square, not round, because they're harder to cut. Get a padlock that's hardened steel. Don't buy the knockoffs; they lie. And that's pretty much it. Lock it well. Lock it to something that, you know, where if I'm a thief, I can say, "Wow, he locked it to a twig. Let me just cut the twig and carry it home." People do that a lot. So that's it. But the square chains are huge. They're heavy and uncomfortable, but they're much harder to beat. That being said, if you have an expensive road bike, just don't lock it. Take it inside.
So as you and other folks might know, in Paris and other centers of world tourism, there's been a trend for people to leave locks on bridges as a symbol of undying love. This got to the point in Paris, where I think it started, that a panel of a pedestrian bridge fell loose because of the weight of all the accumulated locks. I'm just wondering, given your professional background, does a closed lock as a symbol of love strike you? Is it romantic or grotesque or what?
I was in Paris 3 weeks ago, and I was like, God, I wish I would have brought my picture so I can open these fucking locks and get them out of here. So no, I don't see it that way.
There probably is a society of enterprising locksmiths who are like, we're going to undo this. Is there a lock you'd recommend?
For what, though?
Front door. Should we say front door?
Yeah,
you know, front door.
If you live in New York, you have the drop bolt, which is the Siegel-type lock. Definitely put a plate over it. And then if you want to spend money, get a Medico or any kind of pick-proof lock. But since so few people know how to pick locks anymore, if you don't have a lot of money, just make sure you have a plate over it. Get two locks, install one at eye level, one at knee level. Key them alike so you don't have to carry two keys. And use them. Use them. That's the big thing. And everybody's like, yeah, I only had the one locked. And, well, you know, you shouldn't have bought that other one if you were going to use it.
Okay, one last question. What's the craziest thing that ever happened to you in your locksmithing days, either installing or picking?
I mean, that's hard. I've been held at gunpoint 3 times. I've been threatened with pit bulls and machetes and baseball bats. Almost all of that in the 2 years in Miami, mind you. But Miami had that volatile combination of Cuban machismo, cocaine, and guns, so of course you were always...
You got threatened for picking a lock or for installing a lock?
No, I got one was a domestic quarrel where the wife was locking up the husband to beat her up, and he showed up, and he had a gun. One was a coke dealer who was so high he forgot that he called me to change the locks and stuck a gun in my face. And the most pathetic was a really rich guy. It's a very expensive neighborhood in Coral Gables called Cutler by the Sea, and he was offended that he was paid by check, and he was offended that I asked for ID, which is company policy, and he pulled a gun on me for that. So, yeah, there you go.
Dangerous job, intrepid, brave man. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Okay, our next guest is obsessed, possibly majorly, possibly minorly. Please welcome Paul Lucas, who will discuss the evolution of baseball's pantshosery dialectic.
Hi, I am hoping not to have to use this microphone. Can anyone not hear me? Okay, let's try it without the mic, because I'm going to have to use this PowerPoint thingy. Bear with me. So there's going to be something happening up there.
I hope so.
Swiping the wrong way. Here we go.
Ah.
There we go. All right. So we're going to be discussing. All right, I'm going to be my own visual aid for those who can't see. when we get to that point in the presentation. On the left is Babe Ruth of the New York Yankees, the greatest slugger of his day, photo taken about 90 years ago. On the right is another pinstripe New York slugger, that's Lucas Duda of the Mets, in a photo taken last year. What is the difference between the two of them, aside from the fact that Babe, I realize I'm facing the screen. Can people back here hear me? Maybe I'll use this after all. What's the difference between the two of them, aside from the fact that Babe Ruth is in the Hall of Fame and Lucas Duda is unlikely to end up there? The difference is obvious that Babe Ruth has his pants hiked up above his calves so we can see his socks, and Lucas Duda has his pants down at his shoe tops. We don't even know if he's wearing socks. How did this happen? When viewed side by side, it appears that there's been a quantum shift in baseball's lower leg stylings over the last century, but that shift has taken place gradually in phases, and it has involved many elements and influences as baseball pants and hosiery have engaged in an extended push-pull tug-of-war for lower leg dominance, which we can sort of see phases of there. So this presentation, we're going to take a look at the evolution that's taken place and how we got from Babe Ruth to Lucas Duda. We'll begin by looking at baseball history, and to do that we have to go back to the very first baseball teams back in the 1840s. And back then, as you can see in this illustration of the New York Excelsiors, baseball players wore long trousers. And that was pretty much the standard look for baseball until 1868, when a team in Cincinnati did something really groundbreaking. They hiked up their pants and exposed their stockings. And that was, this team was called, of course, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. And the move to expose their stockings was extremely controversial at the time. The team's president later remarked that the showing of the manly leg in varied color hose was unheard of, and when team captain Harry Wright occasionally appeared with scarlet stockings, young ladies' faces blushed just as red, and many high-toned members of the club denounced the innovation as immoral and indecent. But still, this knickers look, with the high-cuff knickers, caught on, and this was pretty much the standard look for baseball teams in the early 1900s, through the end of the 1800s and into the early 1900s. The next big change came, I'm getting ahead of myself. The stockings weren't just an afterthought. They were usually established to define the team's color scheme. And that's why some of the oldest teams that date back to this period that are still with us are called the Red Sox and the White Sox. And in fact, that 1868 team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings, is also still with us today, and they're called now the Cincinnati Reds. And that is the power of baseball's hosiery heritage, if you will. No other uniform element has ever served as the basis for a team name. The next big change came around 1910. At this point, baseball had evolved into a fairly rough-and-tumble sport. Players often sharpened their spikes, and when they slid into second or third base, they would have their spikes up high and try to impale the infielder kind of gouge him in the shins. And the dyes in those days were not yet color-fast, and so if you got spiked in the shins, the dye from your stockings could get in the wound, and you could get an infection or even blood poisoning. And so somebody... it's no laughing matter to get blood poisoning now. I don't know who's laughing. So somebody, we don't know who, got the idea that the players should wear an undersock beneath their colored stockings, and that this would provide an extra layer of protection. The problem was, if you wear your stockings over the undersock, you're essentially wearing two pairs of socks, and your shoes are no longer going to fit. So someone, again, we don't know who, came up with an innovation that changed the look of the sport for most of the rest of the century. And that is the stirrup stocking. It was basically the same as a regular stocking, but with a low-cut cutout at the bottom, which you can see there. So it could be worn over another sock without necessitating another pair of shoes. And so baseball's new hosiery format, which would last for about 80 years, was born. The undersocks, which were usually white, were called sanitaries or sannies because they provided a layer of sanitary protection, and the colored stockings were simply called stirrups. The earliest stirrups were designed to mimic stockings. They had very small openings, just large enough for the player's foot to fit through at the bottom so that very little of the white sanitary undersock would show through. There's Ty Cobb. You can't even see, but he is wearing stirrups over a white undersock. And where's my handy-dandy pointer here? So you can barely see it, but he's got stirrups, and I am wearing something somewhat similar on my left leg. You can't really see, but here's a little bit of elastic on this stocking over a white undersock. Now, almost immediately, however, players started tinkering with their stirrups, and they started pulling them up a little higher and exposing a little more of the undersock. So let's go back to the photo we saw earlier of Babe Ruth and take a closer look. Now, you can see those little crescents of white. He has a little larger stirrup opening, and he's exposing more of the white undersock. And as this went on, and as players started pulling their socks, their stirrups up higher and higher, sportswear manufacturers responded by offering and manufacturing and producing stirrups with larger openings. And so as you go on throughout the rest of the 1900s, these openings and the amount of the exposed white undersock gets bigger and bigger. So through the 30s, that's Joe DiMaggio. The 40s, that's Ralph Kiner. We've got more of the white undersock showing. The 50s, this is about what I'm wearing on my right leg, roughly that ratio. And into the 60s, there's Sandy Koufax. Now here, if we were to do like a real square inch or acreage kind of analysis, I would say that the color to white ratio is about even if we mapped out the area of color versus the area of white. And that shifted as we got into the late 60s. That is Frank Robinson of the Baltimore Orioles. And if we take a closer look at his left leg, his front leg there, you see that little bump? Let's take a closer look. So what's going on there with that seam? The pitcher Jim Boughton, who wrote probably the best baseball book ever written, Ball 4, which was published in 1970 and was essentially the diary of Boughton's 1969 season, explained what's going on there. He said, "It has become the fashion, I don't know how it started, possibly with Frank Robinson, to have long, long stirrups with a lot of white showing. The higher your stirrups, the cooler you are. Your legs look long and cool instead of dumpy and hot. The way to make your stirrups longest, or what are called high cuts, is to slice the stirrup and sew in some extra material." So if we go back and look, that is what Frank Robinson has done there, or probably had done for him. I don't think he personally sewed it in. But he sliced his stirrups and had an extra strip of orange fabric sewn in, and that little bump is the seam. And so a lot of players were doing this, especially African-American players in the late 60s and into the early 70s. And again, stirrup manufacturers responded by saying, well, if this is what the players want, we're going to give it to them so they don't have to, you know, MacGyver their own high-cut stirrups. We'll just give it to them. And so into the 70s and 80s, you had these really long stirrups that are basically just strips of white. Let me catch up.
Are those still functional?
Well, it depends on what you mean by functional. Now, by this point, dyes had become color fast. There was no, and players weren't going out of their way to spike each other anymore either. So there was no risk of blood poisoning or anything like that. Stirrups were no longer functional in terms of the original function, but they had become part of baseball's visual signature. And in that sense, they were functional. And it's, now on the left, that's Jim Rice of the Boston Red Sox. He doesn't have much in the way of red socks, right? He's only got a red stripe. So that's another aspect of the function. Are you really showing your colors anymore if the color has been reduced to just a thin strip? And so the white undersock is now what we see most of. This resulted or sort of came to its logical conclusion with the next development, which was called the ribbon stirrup. That's Greg Maddux, who was then with the Chicago Cubs. And that stirrup, you can see, is literally just a strip of white. And somebody then, again, we don't know who, thought, well, if this has basically been reduced to just a strip of color against a white background, why don't we just offer a sock At this point, there were lots of different styles being offered and lots of different styles being worn. These are the 1986 Mets. Most of them are wearing ribbon stirrups. Second from right is Keith Hernandez wearing sort of a mid-60s style. His pants are a little higher than the others. It's kind of a mishmash. Baseball has never legislated or had any rules regarding what you have to do with your lower leg. There's no lower. It's like the most unregulated, least uniform part of the uniform. You can pretty much do whatever you want. And so it's kind of a visual mishmash. But with more and more players wearing the ribbon stirrups, the strip of color against the white background, that got us to this, which is a one-piece sock, that's again Greg Maddux, wearing what is called a two-in-one. And it's called that because it's two socks in one. It's the stirrup and the undersock, the sanitary, in one. And the stripe is basically knit into the sock. But it's very unsatisfying because you can see, because of the way socks are made, the stripe only goes down so far, and it doesn't quite disappear into his shoe. So you got this little gap here. Very, very unsatisfying. And as more and more players were wearing this style, and their pants, you've probably noticed, are getting a little lower, and that because if you're not really showing much with your socks, if they're not functional in terms of showing your team colors, what's the point of having your pants hiked up? And so more and more players started wearing their pants lower. On the left is George Hendrick, who is usually given credit as being the pioneer of the low pants style. He was an outfielder with the St. Louis Cardinals. On the right is Ron Darling, a pitcher with the Mets. He referred to his low pant cuffs as his no-nonsense look. You can sort of see that George Hendrick on the left is wearing ribbon stirrups. Darling is wearing something similar to what we saw Babe Ruth wearing, conventional stirrups with fairly low openings. But it really doesn't matter what either of them are wearing as socks because we can barely see the socks because the pants are so damn low. When this style was pioneered in the mid and late 80s, it was considered radical. Within like a dozen or 15 years, if we go ahead to 2000, these are the 2000 New York Yankees celebrating their victory in the 2000 World Series. I was actually at that game and saw my Mets, unfortunately, go down to defeat. And you can see all of them have their pants down, either at their ankles or at their shoe tops. And that had become the predominant look by then. If you still want to see stirrups and the high-cuffed look, it's out there. But, you know what? I keep getting ahead of myself. As players were keeping their pants down, they came up with ingenious ways to keep their pants down. Some of them, like Benito Santiago here, put an elastic strip at the pant cuff and looped it under their shoes. Here's his teammate, Barry Bonds, who famously did the same thing. Again, you can sort of see, it's hard to see because the elastic strip is black against his black shoe, but he's got a little stirrup cuff from his pant cuff goes under his shoe to keep the pants anchored down. Other players, like Pedro Martinez of the Mets here, would take their pants and stretch them over the heel and impale it on the back spike of their cleats to keep the pant leg anchored down. Again, maybe he's wearing socks, maybe he's not, we'll never know. Other players did something even weirder. This is Barry Larkin of the Reds, who would cut a slit in the front of his pant cuff and tie his shoes through the slit to keep the pant cuff tied down to his shoe. Really bizarre look. Other players actually had Velcro on their shoes to keep the pant cuff down. And this was just the style of the time, especially in the early 2000s. It was very common to see all these different maneuvers going on to keep the pant cuffs down. And that is sort of the big league look now, to keep your pants all the way down. Stirrups and sanitaries are still used. There we go. Mostly in the minor leagues and in college, mainly because the coaches for minor league and college teams are of an age where they grew up with stirrups. They think that that's what baseball is supposed to look like. It's what they wore when they were playing. And also minor league and college coaches tend to be sort of control freaks who like to impose a certain kind of military style order on their players. And so they'll say, you're all going to do it this way. And they make them do it that way. And unfortunately, when those players, if they're good enough to make it to the major leagues, they think, well, you're not the boss of me anymore. I can dress any way I want now that I'm a big leaguer. I'm going to look like a big leaguer. And unfortunately, looking like a big leaguer now means looking like that, which is just absurd. I can't imagine. About once or twice every season, someone trips on the bases or chasing a ball because he gets his spikes caught in the flap of his baggy low pants. It's yeah, not a good look. When I play softball in Prospect Park, I practice what I preach. I go high-cuffed with a sort of like a mid-60s kind of look. Like to look good out there. to me, that's the right look. That's sort of the platonic ideal, the ratio of color to white. Like that's how every ball player ought to look. Yeah. And if you want to know more about these types of things and about obsessing minorly or majorly about uniform things, I have a website where I pursue this kind of stuff.
Thank you, Paul Lee. I would call that an exemplary minor obsession. So the guests tonight seem to have organized themselves by accident around a kind of theme of security or secrecy, because our second guest is a fact checker for a gossip magazine. So please welcome.
Nothing like tradition, David Levine.
Anonymous, 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 anonymous.
I hope you don't mind if we call you Anon for short.
No,
You can see we've blurred out her face to preserve privacy.
I'm just gonna talk like that.
All right. Well, why does a gossip magazine need a fact checker?
All kinds of reasons. I mean, I think the main one is legal. Celebrities have a lot of money. They also have an image to protect. And they will sue. And so having a fact checker ensures that, I mean, first of all, like there are some very, very basic things that are important to get right, like spelling of names. So that's something that I spend a lot of time doing, making sure people's names are spelled correctly. But yeah, there's like a tiered list of people who appear in the magazine, and it's like if you fuck up on the A list, then that's like really bad. If you fuck up on the B list, it's not so bad, and then you're kind of getting down to just like regular people. But then there are other privacy rules involved.
See, I would assume that the New Yorker knew how to spell people's names.
Well, I can't talk about what magazine I work at. Okay. So yeah. Right.
But if it's rigorously fact checked, is it even gossip any longer?
Well, okay. I mean, okay, so a normal like a fact checker at a other kind of magazine, at a news reporting magazine, would probably they get the story, they mark off all the facts, and then they would probably make some calls, probably have to call the sources themselves. Now, I do not do that. Essentially, I am forwarded like several emails, just like a list of email chains, and then also rely heavily on like what is on the internet already. And so that's something that's really, I think, not that I've been a massive gossip magazine follower before I started working there, but that's something that's changed a lot, is that so much of the magazine now, so many celebrities are already sort of doing their own reporting about themselves via Twitter and Instagram. They don't use Facebook so much, but yeah, Twitter and Instagram. So a lot of stuff is already on there. So you just want to make sure that it's accurate. Now, there are still scoops that the magazine gets. And so those are the things that, is it true? Is it not true? I have to say, I really will never know. It doesn't really matter. It just matters so long as that the celebrity is content with the story being told.
But again, the celebrity, if for it to be gossip,
right?
The celebrity, well, I guess the celebrity shouldn't always be content with the story being told.
Well, maybe not always, but Gossip Magazine runs on an economy of favor, so maybe it's not the celebrity themselves, but you're keeping certain people happy because they are, their flows of information are coming from them, and so you do favors in return, they give you information. So, I mean, the other thing is that, like, is it gossip? I don't know if that really matters. Like, I don't know if, like, ontology matters here. It's just, like, do people who are reading it like think that they are getting gossip? Right.
Right.
That's more important.
Right. So can you? Right. So can you describe like a standard fact-checking chain for a reasonably salacious story? Like it comes to you as a series of emails.
It comes to me, yeah. I mean, usually I'll get some copy first, and then so the way that like the breakdown of work at the magazine is that you know, reporters do reporting and writers do the writing, and the reporters don't write. So the reporters go out and, I mean, I don't even know if the reporters are more just like social actors. They're just like in the scene and they send information. Like sometimes I've looked at the names of the people who are reporters and I'm like, oh, interesting. Okay. But they're like in social diary images a lot. So
like Donald Trump's security. Yeah.
So I'll get some copy and, you know, I'll just do kind of like a basic sweep of the, like the basic facts. So, one thing this magazine does is every time you offer a name, you also have to offer an age. That's something we also have to get right. It's like a cardinal sin at the magazine to get someone's, age wrong. And which is tricky because I guess some celebrities like to have their, you know, ages a little mysterious. I think there was, this was before I worked there, but I believe that Mariah Carey's age was like not printed for many, many, many years.
And you were the ones who broke that news.
No, we did not break that news, but it's just that like this was like at her behest, like she just would not want her name, her age printed, so no one printed it. I have no idea how old she is.
Including your magazine.
Including our magazine, okay. Yeah. I don't think we've really reported on her in a while, so I'm not sure what we do now. So then once I get past all the kind of like very concrete facts that aren't going to change, then I start looking at some of the more sort of like whatever, softer, like the quoted material, the stuff that's coming in from reporting. And I'll usually just want to make sure that, so I'm doing this for the printed magazine, which is already delayed because everything is already on the internet. So there's like another website of another gossip magazine that we rely on as being,
the paper of record.
The paper of record in the gossip magazine world. Yeah. There are different kinds of gossip magazine. Maybe I'm about to give something away, but the one that I work at, like, they're not that interested in like negative portrayals.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So there have been some pretty big scoops. Let's see. They're like. A lot of stories recently about men leaving their wives and sleeping with a babysitter.
And you guys have broken a couple of these.
Yes. Right.
But that raises this question of the economy. Like if you guys are mostly, if the gossip your magazine feeds on is mostly celebrity issued, right? It's mostly like approved leaks, right? Then what's the incentive? What's the incentive to actually break something that's going to piss off a celebrity who you will then never work with again?
Money. I mean, first of all, I don't know that the stories get broken. They're going to come out anyways, so there's always a way of like shaping a story. A story can be told in a lot. The same story can be told in a lot of different ways. So even if we are reporting on this, you know, a certain actor who is like sleeping with his babysitter who's 20 years younger than him.
Could be anyone.
Could be anyone. then, you know, there's a way to spin it as like, oh, well, was he already separated from his wife when he started doing this? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that, like, we're not, as fact checkers, like, usually are not. Well, I don't think that even the reporters really know, although, like, they kind of know. Okay, another thing is that oftentimes I will get information in these emails that says, like, specifically not for print. So sometimes it's actually easy to see the way that the story is being spun or the way that certain information is being taken out. So, like, the story, the celebrities know that, like, certain stories are going to get out about them. They just want to get ahead of it and maybe spin it in the way that they want it to be spun. Like, that puts them in the best light possible, even if it's something negative overall. The other thing is that, like, these kinds of stories sell magazines when you have that on the cover, and that was, like, on the cover for weeks.
Right. Do you, in those cases, is there ever, like, is there ever the traditional, like, do you ever call anyone?
One time when I was...
How would you characterize the statement?
How would I characterize the statement?
Okay.
Well, I don't... So the reason I don't call any sources is because, I mean, this is how... This is what makes the reporters valuable, is that, like, they have their actors in the social world that is, like, very hard to get into. So if they were to just start, like, giving away phone numbers for all the people that they know who are, you know, who they've cultivated over these years, then, like, anyone could do their job and they're no longer valuable. So, they're, like, economically, it doesn't really make sense for them to do proper fact-checking, I guess. But, like, the times I've had to make calls have been, like, very basic things, like George Clooney's wedding. I needed to know how far the boat was from, like, from Italy proper to the island on which the, like, I needed to know how long the boat ride took. So I had to call a ferry service in Italy and ask, how long would it take to get from this place to this place? And I usually just say, you know, I'm checking an article. Sometimes they don't understand what that means, but.
Or you would call a different person and say, okay, if you're having an affair with your nanny.
Right, like, would you do this? Yeah.
Okay, one last question.
Report on talk show hosts not acknowledging their sidemen when they say they're going to.
I did it again.
But also, you said that I would pick a snottier way to call you out on it. I think I just raised my level too. So,
yet another feature.
Please continue.
Let me ask her one more question and then ingredients. I told you I would forget, and I'm a man of my word. One time recently, my wife and I were looking at my anonymous wife, and I were looking at a. We were just passing by a newsstand, and we were struck by the similarity of all the gossip rags. And she asked, "Like, why does everyone use a yellow font?"
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. I don't know. I assume again that it's just in the on the magazine stands. You know, they just stands out among all the other magazines. They're all the same. But I mean, like, if it's on a magazine stand, it's usually there are, like, hundreds of other kinds of magazines there. I don't know. I think people are probably already loyal to their brand, so they just want to know what section the celebrity magazine is in and go there, and it's very identifiable. I don't know. They all have a similar. They use, like, weird fonts, and they're actually, like, the layout is confusing, and it's, like, very hard to find any information, but I think it's just sort of meant to create a kind of sense of there's just a lot going on. It's really exciting.
And yellow with a slightly red outline, yeah, seems to do that. Sure. How do you know when an article is checked?
There's a limited number of facts in the article. I mean, in a certain way that I can possibly check. Also, there are lawyers who sort of review everything and make sure things are okay.
Yeah. We'll turn it over for questions in just a moment. But first, no, let's find out what the ingredients are. People need to think about this. They need some time to mull over this. So,
okay. All right. Today's cocktail, I've been doing a lot of projects in Florida this winter. So I have had a lot of, like, rum on my dossier. And so... this is actually vodka, a dark rum, apricot brandy, lime juice, and coffee. Coffee sort of taking the place of bitters here, or kind of imagining what tiki culture would be like if it had first appeared in Brooklyn instead of San Francisco. And of course, naturally, it would involve artisanal local cold brew coffee. So that's.
So we have rum, coffee, artisanal cold brew coffee, and what else?
Vodka, apricot brandy, and lime.
Rum, vodka, apricot brandy, lime, and coffee. These are your ingredients. Think about the taste, maybe have another. Think about what you would call this drink. Questions for Anonymous. Another reporter, this ought to be good.
I can understand your discretion in not wanting to name your own publication, mm-hmm. but I was hoping for our benefit that you might tell us what, in your view, the paper of record in your profession was.
People Magazine.
This is the old gray lady.
Hi, I'm here. I have a question for you. Most of the fact-checking people disappear from the industry of news. We used to call them the copy desk. They disappear because of like budget restriction. So how big is your community now, and how do you feel to be the last one? And is there like convention for fact-checker or things like that?
Let's see. There's actually a lot of us and who work there, and it's starting to be more and more because the magazine actually has to accommodate online readers. And until like 2 months ago, the magazine was not, the online version was not fact checked, which is interesting. I mean, I there was some very light fact checking happening, and now I should say that because the volume is so high, the checkers actually have to go through an article in about 10 minutes, which is not enough time to check an article properly, as one might imagine. But I think like at our team, let's see, there's about, we all sit together in this pit in the middle of the office. We're kind of like cordoned off from all the important people in the office, which is, there's a funny inversion there because basically everyone who works at this magazine is also like a writer or an artist. So like in this like cordoned off group, there are people who have like written novels and books of poetry and like are sort of like important artists in certain sectors. And but like the rest of the magazine has no idea and they don't care and they kind of treat us like dirt. It's fun, but I think there's like 20 of us on staff at any time between the copy editors and the fact checkers. And, you know, we kind of go back and forth between one another. Like when I'm finished checking a piece, photocopy it, pass it to the, copy editor who enters changes, and then it comes back to me again. Another time we do that again.
Wow.
You mentioned legal concerns as one reason for fact-checking in a gossip publication or column. I've always assumed that in that context, the standard would be not is something true, but can you verify that someone told you it was true, and can you name that person if necessary? Is that about right, or is that off?
That's about right. I think, like, that's true to a certain extent, but, like, also... it matters who that person is. So it can't just be like anyone, because then anyone could say anything about anyone and you could print it. So oftentimes when there's like any kind of, question about whether a story is going to be problematic, like the lawyers want to know who the sources are. They want to know like how close they are to this relationship. One thing that I'll also say is that sometimes, and this happens a lot for certain kinds of celebrities, I would say mostly reality TV show celebrities, is that they act as their own sources. They want to be in the gossip magazine, so they are, it's funny because sometimes you'll just get this email that says like, has source in quotes. So that usually means that there's, that usually means that there's, it's either the rep of the celebrity who is telling us this, or it means that it's a celebrity themselves. And sometimes you'll see like a slip. It's like they're writing in the third person, and then suddenly there's like an I. I'm like, oh, of course, you're writing this about yourself because you want to get out ahead in front of the story and like, you know, spin your relationship on like Housewives of New York, Real Housewives of New York. You know, you just want to, whoever it is who does this. But yeah, because they have certain relationships with the reporters, they just write to them and are like, yeah, we got into a cat fight, but I just want everyone to know that I'm really hurt. And, you know, I hope she apologizes to me. Yeah.
And then you call them up and be like, are you really hurt?
Are you really hurt? No, of course not. Look, they're writing, I think that they're writing their own autobiographies. It's like a slow leak autobiography. It's the novel of the 20th and 21st century. The, you know, the serial novel.
And a creative novel, yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
We heard about the route to becoming a locksmith and how Alberto trained and so forth. Yeah. How does one become a fact checker? Or how did you, and is your route typical?
It seems to be typical for the place where I work. I mean, I had no experience like fact checking at another magazine when I was hired for this. It's not like, I should say this is not like what I do 5 days a week. It's just a job that I ended up taking a couple of years ago because I needed to just sort of like fill in some freelance gaps. And the really nice thing about it is that like it's one of the few remaining jobs where you just go into work and then you work for 7 hours or 8 hours or 9 hours or 10 hours, and then you go home and like no one emails you afterward. No one's like, where's that thing I asked you for? They're not like emailing you at 11 o'clock at night unless you're at the office, which happens. So I liked it because it was just like I would just go in and get money, and like usually they feed you and they also give you cars to go home in and stuff like that. So it seemed nice. But yeah, basically a friend of mine had already worked there. As I said, there were a lot of other people who are artists and writers who are working there. So I actually knew like 7 people who worked there already. And like there's a literary magazine in Brooklyn whose like younger staff is almost entirely made up of people who work at this gossip magazine to make money.
In other words, it's a gossip magazine in Brooklyn.
And, yeah, exactly. So I just got a job through them. So it's not really like a typical. But I just went in. I don't even the research chief is great. I mean, she didn't really like ask me a lot of questions. She just looked at my CV. We had like a brief conversation, and then. And then she tried me out. So I think that's the only way. It's not like she'll just give you a chance as long as someone else vouches for you. I don't know if that
kind
really
of like
works.
The way facts get checked.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't, but you know, people don't get asked back all the time. Yeah, it's kind of awkward.
Because why?
Well, if you make a mistake and it goes to print and someone reads it, publicists know when their clients are going to appear in the magazine, and they're checking everything to make sure that it's
right
to their liking,
right,
or not to their liking, but at least accurate.
Since you're in the industry, there was a $115 million verdict, I think, against Gawker based on invasion of privacy principles because they published a sex tape. And I think people have been predicting that people in your industry will feel a chill as a result and not be able to report on delicious celebrity gossip as a result. Do you think that's happening?
I don't know. I guess that verdict just happened pretty recently. I mean, that's the kind of thing that my magazine would never, ever publish. TMZ would publish that, and that's another place that we often look to for... I know, but it's kind of amazing. But they actually, I don't know, people read the piece in the New Yorker, but they do a really good job. Their stuff is usually right.
So they're like the crusaders in this,
yeah,
in this
exactly.
kind of setup.
Yeah.
And people is the kind of like...
Yeah, they tried, the people try, they're a little more staid. They try to be serious. Like sometimes they do more kind of like serious articles. People also has like they have a great database on like celebrity pets. You have to get the dog's name right.
Yeah.
Celebrity babies also. It's a great place to go for celebrity babies.
It's like the LexisNexis.
Yeah, well, I use LexisNexis all the time. Public records. You can find out anyone's birthday.
Right.
If they're, as long as they're an American citizen. And where they live. And usually their email addresses.
Oh. Huh.
If they have used an email address to log into a website from that has been crawled.
You mentioned...
Wow, dangerous knowledge.
Yeah.
You mentioned publicists know that when their clients are being written about, when it's a potentially really damaging story against somebody really big, Do you ever have a preemptive strike where their legal team is calling the magazine before anything comes out, kind of intimidating you?
Yeah, that's usually like not information that I would necessarily be privy to, but yeah, there are like conversations between legal teams, I think, going on in advance.
Do you ever have to fact check against your own fact checking from a previous time, and do you uncover some things which were not noticed, but if you go with the flow, then you have to stick with the original story?
That's a good question. I mean, usually there have been times when I have come across, this happens actually quite often, where I will be checking a story and then go to the editor and say, you know, I think that this thing is a little bit questionable. And then they will say, well, that's what we printed. And so then I'm like, okay. So basically the kind of rule is that we just go with our reporting. And usually what we have reported in the past, like, I think there was something in the last like 2 years or the last year and a half that I think we had to backtrack on, but that happened like rather quickly. But yeah, usually I haven't come across anything that's like crazy, but just like small details that I have thought were possibly inaccurate that we're just going with anyways, because that's what we've already said, and we don't really want to change our story.
I'm wondering how reading about celebrity gossip constantly maybe affects you. Like, do you find yourself accidentally thinking about something that you're working on, or sort of how does that impact your mental space?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I actually think about it a lot. Before I worked there, I honestly, like, I barely knew who Kim Kardashian was. So it's been...
Sure.
No, it's... you cannot believe me, but it's kind of true. So it's been interesting in that way. But I think one thing that is kind of... that I think about a lot is actually just, like, how banal a lot of this information is. Like, it's most of the stuff that we print is very like it's like, oh, they were seen like eating a slice of pizza, isn't, like, they're just like us, it's so exciting. So yeah, it's really I don't know, but it's pretty banal stuff, and so it makes me wonder about, like, I don't know why. I think a lot about why people are so fascinated with celebrities, why we want them to be like both our heroes, but also so much like ourselves. I've also spent a lot of time thinking about, because I spend so much time on their Instagram accounts and stuff like that, like how they are sort of like crafting their self-image and like the kind of conversation that goes on between how like people in our social media maybe kind of like craft their image on social media, and how celebrities are doing it, and sort of like which, like, who is stealing from whom in terms of sort of like their strategy, like the strategies of creating self.
But it hasn't tempted you to like leak your own news?
No, not at all.
Okay. Anonymous was seen.
I think it seems, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it seems really, seems like it can be very addictive. And I don't know. I just don't want to spend all my time doing that.
Well, that raises kind of my last question, which is, so you fact check for a print gossip magazine, which means, as you said, the news is already late. So what do you think the appeal is of a print gossip mag as opposed to just refreshing your anonymous magazine or TMZ? Like why go buy it when the news is late?
That's a good question. So I think the pictures are a huge part of this economy. So the PAPS often, it's short for paparazzi, by the way.
The PAPS. Not the pops.
No, the PAPS. Okay. Yeah. It's kind of gross. their photos are often sold with a disclaimer that they're only for print. And I don't know. I think that there's actually like a really interesting history. I always hear the guy who's in charge of photos like going on these kind of like tirades to the staff around him, and I sort of like linger back there, and I'm like, I'm just looking at this photo, just checking it out so I can listen to him, because he's always talking about how the industry has changed. But yeah, I think that the paparazzi often will sell their photos, and for whatever reason, I guess they're just worth a lot more when they're in print. So it's only for print. It's obviously like for like kind of important stories, like this babysitter that I mentioned, or the affair with the babysitter. Those photos, I mean, I don't know what they bought them for, but I imagine it was a lot of money. And they weren't great photos. They were pretty grainy, but you know, it was like, there they are, like getting out of their car together at night on the street. And there was like, there were a lot of questions because they were maybe on private property, and you're not supposed to show that necessarily. I think that's what it is, that there are different kinds of pictures that show up in the print magazine.
Which is weird though, because the print, I've bought them once or twice. Yeah. Like on weekends. The print quality is actually the print quality is actually pretty shitty. Yeah, I mean, that's what's weird, is it's shockingly bad print quality.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter about the print quality. It's just like, oh my, you know, it's just the information. It's not the quality. You just want to see the celebrity doing that thing. Then you can't see online. Now, I mean, I don't know, again, just based on what I see changing in the magazine, the fact that they're like investing in this, in the online, the online reporting or the online publishing, that makes me feel like maybe there's a nervousness.
There's a what?
A nervousness about the magazine becoming less relevant. Again, I would say especially because celebrities have social media accounts and are sort of like already getting out ahead of things.
Oh man, death of print culture, gossip mags.
Yeah, well, I think it's, just changing somewhat.
Everything we've managed to actually have a theme, not everything connected to Mary, we actually coherence, everything about changing industry, all three of them.
It's true,
yeah.
Disrupted gossip. Does anyone have any more questions for Anonymous? Because this will probably be the last time you'll ever get a chance to ask a gossip magazine fact checker a question, unless you know one and they're just not telling you.
Can you tell us about a time that you got something wrong?
There hasn't been a time that I've gotten something wrong, to my knowledge, except once, where apparently I was saved by Thanksgiving. I was working on like a fashion page, I think, and there was a website that I missed a letter. So that's the only thing I've gotten wrong. But it was actually probably could have gotten fired for that.
Because you violated the canons of gossip journalistic ethics, or?
Well, no, just because that publicist would have been pissed off.
Right.
But
that's not the copy editor's job.
No, it's the fact checker's job. Yeah, I was surprised to learn that when I arrived and started working there. Yeah.
Okay, guys, we have drinks to name. There's a couple more questions, but you can totally catch Anon afterwards. So, should we review the ingredients?
Okay, so it's vodka, dark gold rum, apricot brandy, lime juice, and coffee.
Okay, any names for this delicious cocktail that I've now had three of? What?
Cubana Macaulay, you have two strong Cuban flavors, and Obama was just in Cuba.
So, what are you calling it?
Cubana Macaulay.
Cubana Macaulay. Okay, Cubana Macaulay.
Anonymous locksmith.
The anonymous locksmith.
Wired pirate.
Wired pirate, okay. Oh. Wow. Yeah, I should have said they can be thematically named or ingrediently named or any combination thereof. Okay, so that's four names.
First drink I ever by executive command, just say that's the name no matter what. But I'm gonna let democracy appear to work for a second.
Okay, so Cubana Macaulay.
Thank you, Zed.
Any arms, anyone? Cubana Macaulay? You got one. Ali says yes. Yeah. Wait, are you voting for him or not?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. That's what I said. All right. So one for Cubana Macaulay. Two was the anonymous locksmith. One. Aww. All right. Okay, anonymous locksmith one, Cubana Macaulay one, and then we had the...
Wired pirate.
The wired pirate. Yeah,
but it's gonna be
number four. The wired pirate.
Democracy works.
And then we had the dark and jumpy. How many for the dark and jumpy? Yeah. All right. Well, then you've been drinking dark and jumpies. You can drink more. Please thank Anonymous for risking her reputation to be here tonight. And out of her magazine. So we're doing two more of these. If you all, this is a brand new feature. If you guys have any thoughts about a profession that you've always wondered about, please, can they send an email to Cabinet? Please, what? Please send an email to info@cabinet.com saying, I would really love to hear about what it's like to be X. We've done everything from exterminators to tugboat captains to department store Santas. So they can be very high end, they can be so basic that you would never think to ask, but you'd be, like, I'm still furious that I cannot get a subway conductor or a garbage collector, and they're very difficult, let alone a coffin maker. Because there's a coffin factory right up the street. But they're like clammed up because the industry has changed. So if you have any friends who know much too much about something that isn't their job and you think they would love to give a slide talk on that topic, we've had interspecies animal friendships, we've had obscure songs sung by nuns. We've had all manner of things.
Umbrellas
and the Pants-Hoisery dialectic. You can also recommend them to us through info@cabinet.com.
Speaking of Cabinet, I'd just like to say it's great to be home.
Yeah. Thank you to Cabinet for hosting us again. Thank you, EK. Thank you to our guests, and thank you to all of you. See you later.